This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his State of the Union address earlier this year, President Obama promised to make paid leave for new parents a priority.
So it's time we stop treating childcare as a side issue or as a women's issue and treat it like the national economic priority that it is for all of us.
While parental leave has been shown to benefit in the early development and health of newborns, Jennifer Senior argues the policy should not stop after the first 12 weeks. Jennifer is contributing editor for New York Magazine, where we found her article, The Case for Taking Parental Leave When Kids Are Teenagers. She's also author of the book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, which is just out in paperback. And Jennifer, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So is that tongue-in-cheek, you know, taking parental leave for teenagers? Why are the teenage years so important?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked if it was tongue-in-cheek, because of course it is, in the sense that right now we don't even have a paid maternity or paternity leave policy for, you know, newborns. So I don't expect this to happen anytime soon. And I don't by any means want to trivialize the importance of the early years, right? It's just that there's a lot of very interesting and compelling data about the complications of the teen years, that's all. And what I was keying off of was this one extremely interesting study that looks at whether there's any correlation between how much time parents spend with their children and outcomes. And I mean outcomes along a variety of axes, you know, whether it's academic performance or behavior or emotional well-being. And the striking conclusion of the study was that there really is almost no difference. It doesn't matter how much time you spend with your kid, right? The outcomes are not correlated to time. They're much better correlated to sort of socioeconomic level and education levels, except for this one thing. Adolescence, the more time you spend with adolescents, engage time, if you're a mother, that seems to reduce delinquency. And both parents, if you spend more time with your kids, that tends to improve outcomes across a broad array of areas, including academic performance, some behavioral stuff, some emotional stuff. So it seems to have an effect.
So parents are, you know, if we're talking about adolescents, there are specific things that are potentially at risk for adolescents. What are some of the things that active parenting can help with?
Well, here's the thing, right? One of the bigger findings, and it was not a huge statistical difference, but it was enough for the authors to see, is delinquency, right? So substance abuse, right? Smoking, drinking, all that stuff, experimenting with drugs, lying, bullying, getting arrested. I mean, delinquency was very broadly defined here. All that stuff went down, right? And here's the thing. I mean, you're not, as one of my favorite adolescent psychologists and researchers said to me, you're not going to find an 8-year-old sitting at home experimenting with drugs, right? That's something that happens during the teen years. I mean, from the point of view of, you know, the brain's neurocircuitry, the teen years are really interesting years because adolescent brains are awash in dopamine, which means they feel things very, very intensely.
Mm-hmm.
It means that they also, and that they experience pleasure very acutely. Their prefrontal cortexes are not done developing, which means that they are not terrific at self-restraint and at all kinds of executive kind of decision-making. They don't plan well. They don't, self-regulate particularly well. But they have sort of an outsized sense of how rewarding a risk is going to be. So you can you know, imagine that during the years when your kid's brain is sort of the way that Steinberg thinks of it is that they're like cars with very sensitive accelerators but very weak brakes. That you can imagine that during that time, a parent might have more of an interest in being around, right?
Okay, so parents really are the anti-drug, you know, something that we've been hearing for years.
I don't know if it—well, that's funny. I mean, I think that some of it boils down to this. When adolescent kids misbehave, people sort of think that they are misbehaving in the backseat of a car on a weekend. And the peak time for adolescent malfeasance is between 3 and 6 o'clock, and it tends to be in their own home, so or the home of a friend. So simply by being at home, simply by being there, you are functioning as a deterrent. And the interesting thing about adolescent kids is we have this idea that they hate their parents, that they despise adult company, that they find us a drag. But if you actually survey adolescents themselves, they will give their parents exceedingly low marks for not knowing what's going on in their lives. And in a very wistful kind of way, they wish their parents knew more. So in that way, it's kind of win-win all around.
So we were joking earlier about, you know, can you take family leave to spend time with your adolescents? But there are some allowances, aren't there, for parents to take leave if their adolescents are in, what, serious trouble?
If they're in, that's exactly it. So the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, allows you to take care of someone who's seriously ill.
Now, what
right?
does that mean?
I mean, it's... Exactly. So that's the point. So does your kid who is like kind of his grades are slipping and he just wrapped his car around a tree, but he's fine. Is he seriously unwell or is he simply 17 or 16? You know, I mean, you'd have to make the case to your employer that he was in the care of a physician in an ongoing way being treated for something chronic. So if your adolescent is suffering from real, you know, acute depression, if your adolescent is really struggling in a significant way with drugs or alcohol, then, you know, you'll be able to get the kind of documentation you need. But if you simply want to just kind of make sure that they are not going a little bit off the rails or too much off the rails, you know, I don't know. I guess there would be doctors who would be willing to write notes for that. But I don't know how parents are going to make that determination. I think the point is that if adolescence in general requires a little bit more vigilance because adolescent brains are slightly hinky until they're not, you know, then it's something between the Family Medical Leave Act and what we have now, which is zero, would be nice.
A recent study by the Journal of Marriage and Family is making a big splash by saying that parents don't necessarily need to spend more time with their kids. My guest, Jennifer Senior, however, is making a case for spending more quality time when it really matters. That's in the adolescent years. Jennifer, you just mentioned the Family Medical Leave Act. Have there been any other efforts to address the care of adolescent children specifically?
It's interesting. Members of Congress in both the House and the Senate have scribbled in extra kind of wording into a bill that says that if, you know, Congress gets around to sort of funding or mandating sick leave, part of what it should be is that it should allow parents to leave for parent-teacher conferences. That is a very small thing. It's really small. But at least it's something. I mean, your kid's teacher notices that your kid's suffering or acting out or doing whatever, you can at least be there. So this led, you know, to a discussion that I had with Lawrence Steinberg about, well, how about just taking the occasional afternoon off to check in on your kid, to be with your kid, to do stuff with them, right? Just to make sure that they're not veering wildly, you know, off course.
I'd love to key into that because your article was in response to this large-scale family study that was released last week, I guess, by the Journal of Marriage and Family. It's made a huge splash because it challenges some very long-held myths about spending time with kids. You know, first of all, it says busts the myth of working mothers don't spend enough time with their children, counters this idea that the more time that you spend with your kids, the better, and that the best parents have lives dominated by their children. So that idea of taking time off still reinforces this idea that if you are a working parent, you are not spending enough time with your kids.
Well, what was interesting is that the only way that study said that spending extra time with your kids made any difference at all was during adolescence. And mothers, it was only in terms of curbing delinquency. It was actually with both parents. Both were needed to curb like a kind of wider variety of problems. But for mothers, it was a very small thing, and it was only during adolescence. I mean, it was still, like I said, not a very big statistical effect, just one that people could read. But that study also, you know, it has since come under fire from Justin Wolfers writing in the New York Times, saying that he thought the methodology was, you know, terrible. So it's been criticized. The problem is that, of course, this methodology is the gold standard for all American time use studies. So if he's going to throw out that one, he'd have to throw out practically everybody has ever cited. The other thing is that, you know, it had a big enough sample size that it still should have been able to kind of overcome some of his reservations about it. But just so you know, the study has itself come under fire for its, you know, methods. I still think it's pretty good, personally.
Yes, I think a lot of parents do, because it's alleviated a lot of guilt.
Right. But if we can go to that for a second. I mean, I don't find the results of this study particularly surprising, because ever since women have started working, we've been spending more time with our kids.
Well, that amazes me. It just amazes me. So what were our parents doing?
Well, this is the thing. I can tell you exactly what they were doing. Back in the 60s, women spent much less time with their kids than moms do now. Even working moms who work outside the home, spend more time with their kids than moms did in the mid-60s. And the reason for this is very simple. Moms in the mid-60s were keeping a perfect house. They were buffing their floors to a high shine. They were making sure that there was no more ring around the collar. They were making impeccable and scrumptious meals. But they were putting their infants in playpens, and they were telling their young kids to get on their bikes and play out in the street and to not come back until 6 o'clock when they banged a gong. Now, none of us can cook, and our houses are absolutely filthy, but we all spend a lot of time with our kids. So what we're neglecting by going off to work is not our children, it's our houses. Our houses are the problem. Like, they're what's a mess, but our kids are getting more time than ever. So I never thought that, I mean, so the idea to even be looking at this question is driven by this anxiety sort of that this culture has and this great ambivalence that we still all have about women working. But the fact is, the more women have worked, the more time they've spent with their kids. The two have risen in tandem.
Well, the house can wait then. Jennifer Senior, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Senior is contributing editor for New York Magazine, and she wrote The Case for Taking Parental Leave When Kids Are Teenagers. You'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. She's also author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. The book is now out in paperback. And Word of Mouth returns with the epitome of teenage angst on the silver screen, James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause.
You're tearing me apart!
The roots of the teen movie, after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
From Mean Girls to Clueless to Fast Times at Ridgemont High, teenagers are great fodder for film. Just take a look at the director John Hughes catalog.
What was that? Eat my shorts.
You just bought yourself another Saturday, mister.
Oh, I'm crushed.
What about prom, Blaine?
Oh, Andy, I'm having a bad day. Can we talk later?
No. What about prom?
Come on, why don't we just meet after school?
No! What about prom?
Andy, come on.
Just say it.
What?
Just say it.
Anderson?
Here.
Bueller?
But the roots of the teen movie go back much further than Ferris Bueller. WNYC's Sarah Fischko brings us the story.
It is generally agreed upon and often stated that the first and most emblematic teenage moment on film is in Rebel Without a Cause, 1955. It occurs at the beginning of the film, just as Jim Stark, played by James Dean, is being picked up by his mom and dad from the local jail, where he's been detained for drunkenness. He looks at his bewildered, annoying parents and says,
"You're tearing me apart!"
That's supposed to be the line and the movie that started it all. By that time, after the poverty of the Great Depression, after the sacrifices of the war years, we'd finally reached a period of enough affluence for teens to be in a sort of existential mess filled with questions of identity. they became fixtures on American screens. Before all this, the American teenager was barely an idea. The word teenager itself was only about 10 years old in 55. The first inkling of a need for a transitional period between childhood and adulthood began to dawn on us in the early 20th century.
A group of psychologists and social scientists start discovering this sort of chronological realm in human existence known as adolescence.
Thomas Doherty's book, Teenagers and Teen Pics, looks at what he calls the juvenilization of movies in the 1950s and the history of teendom.
Mainstream culture talks about it as the younger generation, or the problem of the younger generation, usually. And then around the Second World War, you get that phrase that we use, teenager. And that enters the Dictionary of American Slang around 1945. And that's when this creature that has been with us ever since really starts emerging in American culture.
As the idea was absorbed gradually into the culture, so it appeared in the movies. The teens of what you might call the pre-Dean era are completely different specimens in a market that had not yet been defined. Because, after all, in those days, everybody went to the movies, so the movies were made for everybody.
So if you look at, you know, representative classical Hollywood films, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Wizard of Oz, they have a pretty wide generational scope in them.
George, Harry, come down to dinner this minute.
You got, you know, grandparents, sort of older married adults, you got very young kids, you got young people and the boy and the girl and all that, because they configured cinema as being for this big undifferentiated mass.
It's the undifferentiated mass that allowed for the Andy Hardy series to be born in the 1930s.
Look, Dad, can I talk to you man to man?
That's the way I always wanted to be.
Stories of Judge Hardy and his family, with Mickey Rooney as his teen son, struggling to become a grown-up.
Well, man to man, Dad. Can a guy be in love with two girls at once?
In the Andy Hardy films, the purpose is basically to reinforce the wisdom of good old Judge Hardy, Andy's dad. And, you know, every film they have this man-to-man talk, and Judge Hardy gives Andy the advice that will serve him in good stead as he becomes an adult. So these films are very much part of the older model of instruction.
Oh, Dad, you don't have to worry. I'm never going to get married, ever.
That's a momentous decision.
It's a different model of adult, too, of course. You take wise old Judge Hardy, epitome of the head-shaking, all-be-darned, all-knowing dad, and put him up against a more domestic Jim Backus, who played James Dean's father in 1955.
Hello. Hi, Jimbo. You thought I was Mom?
Crawling around on his knees in an apron, you know, not exactly an admirable patriarchal authority figure for Jim Stark in Rebel Without a Cause.
Less than 10 years after Love Finds Andy Hardy, in the post-World War II America of the best years of our lives, the admirable patriarchal authority figure, Dad, has been away in the war.
It's a samurai sword, Rob. Thanks very much, Dad.
He returns to his town and his family only to find that the world has moved on. He barely recognizes his children, who now, in teenhood, look and talk like young adults.
You're just kidding me, Dad. You've been to all these places and you've seen everything.
With no apparent teen characteristics.
I've seen nothing. I should have stayed home and found out what was really going on.
Later in the 40s, you had films like The Bachelor and The Bobby Soxer. Shirley Temple, no less, teenaged, with a crush on grown-up Cary Grant. By that time, teenagers, the word had just gone from the adjective teenaged to the noun, had some of their own lingo and the beginnings of a teen life.
Mal greetings, yookie dookie.
Dickie.
Ready, poop? Let's go.
Wait.
In Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer,
step right up and get yourself a sack.
One central scene is a small town sack race. Contrast that with cars zooming off cliffs in Rebel only 8 years later, and you can get a feel for how fast the culture is moving. A lethal version of the pre-Dean teen turns up in film noir, too, in the late 40s.
I've been thinking.
What about?
Anne Blythe's awful, money-hungry, murderous Vida in Mildred Pierce. She is a teen with no redeeming social values.
What if you marry him? Maybe we could have a maid like we used to, and a limousine.
And no peers.
And maybe a new house.
She'd rather fool around with Mom's rich, fading playboy husband than friends her own age. That's the hallmark of the pre-Dean teen, really. All of them want to grow up to be adults. good adults like Andy Hardy, or bad adults like Vito.
You don't really think I could be in love with a rotten little tramp like you, do you?
Only a few years later, and we're into The Wild One.
Pop me, Dad. I popped you, Dad.
Brando and his biker friends.
Stop me, will you, Daddy-o? Come on, that's it. Stop me. Now give me some skin and ooze it out. Just nice.
Youth has arrived, traveling in packs. They want to be who they are, in their generation.
To pick up on this jive, this crazy.
They proclaim their culture, which by now they own completely.
What? The rebob, Dad, the rebob. He's a square, man. Don't you get this at all?
A year later, there was James Dean. Surely Brando had paved the way. Dean even said as much. He famously gave his pal Dennis Hopper an explanation of his aesthetic. He said, "I've got Brando in one hand saying, screw you. And I've got Montgomery Clift on the other hand saying, help me. Somewhere in the middle is James Dean." So where did Brando and Clift come from? Well, they had Mickey Rooney in one hand saying, gee whiz, and Anne Blythe in the other saying, I don't care. In other words, they, along with James Dean, invented something quite new that turned movie teens completely around forever. From the Fishko Files, I'm Sarah Fishko.
Up next, word of mouth waxes nostalgic for that particular anticipation and the good old days of the darkroom and the one-hour photo. We're going to test a new app that turns your smartphone into an old-school disposable camera. And that's coming up after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A couple of months ago, we talked to Greg Beck. He's the creator of a counterintuitive photo app called The White Album, which basically turned your smartphone into a disposable camera. So here he is explaining how the app works.
It's really, really simple. So you get it on your phone and you take a roll, essentially, of 24 photos. And when you're done shooting, you just order them and you don't have to think about it again. And it just gets sent to your door, these physical photos printed on really premium paper in a nice package.
But I don't get to look at the photographs after I've taken them.
That is the big twist. Yeah. So when you take the photos, we sort of encourage you to just be in the moment a little bit. And so you don't get to reflect on the photos immediately. There's no instant gratification. You can't edit them or post them to a social network or even delete them. You just take them and then move on. And then you get to relive these moments when they're in your hands as printed photos.
Greg said he came up with the idea for his app when he was on a trip to Korea. He was snapping hundreds of photos on his phone, and at some point, he realized that the likelihood that he would actually print any of them out was pretty slim. They simply didn't have that individual value that they would if he had a limited number of shots, the way we used to before digital cameras and smartphones. It was on that same trip that he sat down with a Korean family as they went through an old photo album.
And oddly enough, when we're going through some of these old photos, be they a week old or a year old or 10 years old, some of those quirkier ones or blurry ones, just because they're not perfect or professional quality that'll be showing in a gallery somewhere, there's still something really special about that, knowing that you took it, you were there with that person, and it's okay that they blinked.
Greg wanted to see if a smartphone app could recreate that anticipation of picking up your photos at the pharmacy or passing around boxes of old family photos. So our producer, Logan Shannon, downloaded the White Album app. And at the same time, producer Taylor Quimby shot a roll of film on an old-school disposable camera. Well, the prints are in, so the word-of-mouth crew gathered in the studio to see how they came out.
Well, why don't we look at the White Album pictures first?
And okay.
That's those ones.
All right, those are the ones that...
Oh.
And a box. And an album.
Very nice packaging.
The anticipation is over. Enjoy your photos.
Oh, my goodness.
Ooh, yeah, Taylor's
they feel nice. The paper feels kind of...
Oh, cool. They're kind of, it's kind of like a Polaroid.
Oh, there's Virginia.
Oh, no, is it? I have to see that.
That's actually a great picture.
Yeah. These are nice. They are like Polaroids. They have a thick lower frame.
Yeah, I'm gonna...
I skipped ahead.
What? So you could see yourself?
Yes.
That is so like, right? That's what I used to do. Maureen and I were just talking about that. We'd flip through to see pictures of ourselves.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's a sign of how long it took you to finish out this role.
Yeah,
is that
all
I still have my
back.
Goatee in that picture. I shaved that off like a month and a half ago.
Wow. How long has it been?
So the first photo was on February 10th, and the last photo I took was March 17th.
Logan, yeah. What took you so long?
Yeah, so part of it was sometimes I would forget that it was there. But then often when I need to take a picture using this app, I would open the app and I would feel a little like, oh, this is a special picture. Mm-hmm. This isn't a regular picture that I'm taking. And I'll admit that in some cases with these pictures, I would take a picture with my camera.
Oh, a rehearsal.
Oh, that's cheating. Rehearsal. It is cheating. And I did it.
But that's there would be other times where probably, you know, you'd be like, oh, I want to take a picture of this, but I want to be able to see it. I want to take multiple pictures. I want to make sure they're good.
Yeah.
So I'll use my phone like a normal camera.
Yep.
And then now I'll take the one off with my disposable camera app.
Right.
So which is interesting because one matters and one doesn't. Yeah. You know, sort of one you just toss off.
Yeah.
And then the other you actually think through.
I have to say, I was expecting them to be more disastrous. I mean, there's definitely some that are better than others, but I was expecting it to feel more like it does when you get a disposable camera back and you're like, oh my, why did I take a picture of that?
No, those were really cool.
Yeah, nice. It looks like you thought them through.
Well, I did. I think I was super self-conscious about it in the sense that I really wanted them to be good because I knew that we would all be sitting in here. I really felt like I was back at art school and people were going to be critiquing me, so I needed to be on my game.
See, now this is funny because I had the opposite reaction. So we basically, at the same time that Logan was taking the pictures with the White Album, we ended up getting an actual disposable camera. And that was, for the most part, in my possession. And I was deliberately taking almost bad pictures. I would, like, take pictures at points where nobody was paying attention. You know, I just sort of, like, whipped out the camera and took pictures whenever. So I think we're going to see.
Yeah.
Some more of the classic.
Oh, are there those ones that like where your fingers like obscuring half of the photo?
Actually, Taylor, you just pulled this all out. You get negatives. You don't get negatives.
Oh, actually, no. These aren't negatives. They don't give you negatives anymore. It's a CD.
Oh, they give you.
Also,
CD.
I had to take this to CVS. They had to mail it to I think North Carolina. It took 2 weeks. It was $18, so it was the same price basically, except I had to go to CVS and then pick them up 2 weeks later.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so to be honest, Finn took some of these pictures.
And Finn is?
Finn is
my 3-year-old son.
It's so funny. The lighting is so harsh with the old school disposable camera.
They're awful. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the reason I think that you just point and click is because you know they're going to be bad pictures.
Oh, my gosh. And they're so grainy.
Yeah.
There's something way more nostalgic about, even though the quality is so much worse with the Taylor's disposable camera, that feels... More old school. Yeah.
Well, that's because they look bad. They're bad photos. You don't see bad photos anymore.
I know,
but I don't know if that's a fair comparison because he just tossed them off and Logan really thought about them and really composed them.
Yeah, but look at this. Like, you would never see this on an iPhone because an iPhone...
Right, that's a terrible...
You know, this is like
a terrible, grainy... This one is shot inside of the studio, so it's actually dark.
I mean, how often... With your iPhone, like, how often do you actually use a flash?
Never.
Never.
I avoid it.
And with a disposable camera, you have to use the flash every time because if you don't use a flash, it's totally dark.
I can't believe you spent $18 on these.
Oh, well, I'm going to write that off.
Look at the color of the walls in our office. That's so weird. It just is really... It's a greenish cast on everything.
So I guess the question now is it worth it? You know, I mean, is it really worth it either to use the White Album on your iPhone or to still pick up disposable camera... You know, and actually send your film away. Is it worth it these days?
I think the White Album is interesting. And I think, you know, I'm a sucker for packaging, for one thing. The packaging is beautiful. The presentation is beautiful. And the mood is different. And I think it is because we have a reference for the disposable camera. As you were saying, you know, it's just that kind of thing you pick up and shoot. But these are more considered more like an old school... What is it, 110 camera or, you know?
I don't know. It's hard. The thing for me is that you can't go back. So it's like, you know, you use this on your phone, you have the White Album, it's cool, But like you said, Logan, you were also just using the normal camera function on your phone to take pictures at the same time. So it's like we like to pretend that we can go back to a time when things were simpler and photos were physical. But at the same time, like, you can't actually go back in time.
And I think if you go back truly nostalgic to this old school, you know, disposable camera, looking at the quality of these, it doesn't bring me back in a good way. I wouldn't want to go back to these. It reminded me of like, oh, yeah, that was so annoying when you used to get a disposable camera or a camera when you were in high school and take photos and like only a third of them were good.
Right. It was never worth it. And yeah. I think from my perspective, you know, having recently cleaned out my mother's and father's house and getting these old photographs that have this sense of preciousness. You know, they contain something that's so precious. And it is because, sort of like you were saying, Taylor, you're not, you know, we can't go back in time and capture that sense of preciousness. And, you know, why pretend? But I actually wondered if looking at these piles of photos, like we have the White Album photos all nicely stacked and fanned. We've just thrown all of the disposable photos like in the middle of the table, like a pile of rot or something like that, because they don't, there's something about meaning.
We should put these all in a time capsule and look at them again.
And I'll be like, nope, they're still,
nope, still a lousy photo.
Now, if you'd like to see the photos that we took, we posted a selection on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, why did Blink become Blink 182? And why would a band call itself Dinosaur Jr.? We're going to find out why some notable bands have been forced to change their names. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
Boy, you got me craving sweets again.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to the song Candy, the first tune released by the actress Scarlett Johansson's new all-girl band, The Singles. Or at least that was their name for about 48 hours, until another band that's used the same name for the past 15 years cried foul. Now Johansson and her bandmates have to come up with a new moniker. And here to offer some guidance is Pat Healy. Healy writes about music, and he's a contributor to Paste magazine, and recently looked at some other notable bands forced to change their names. Pat, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. This must have been a lot of fun to research.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to research, and I had knowledge of a lot of these bands over time and what they went through. But to really dig in and find out, you know, the original bands, like who the original Wham was. It was a Texas disco band, or who the, you know, it's so funny too, you know, just the consistencies within these cases. A lot of times the bands who have claimed to the original names are these jam bands, but you know, the bands who are more popular are inevitably the ones who are forced to change their name. But the original bands who have claimed to the name, they keep it, and a lot of times they persevere. And you know, this lounge performer named Suede from Maryland has been going at it since, oh, I guess the 80s, but she's still around. And, you know, the London Suede still has to call themselves the London Suede if they want to put out any new music.
So you outline a couple of different strategies the bands have used when changing their name. What's the most common one?
Well, they just alter it slightly. And that is, you know, because they already have a foothold on a fan base, and they don't want to lose that fan base by changing it entirely. So you take somebody, and these are just two recent examples. There's the electronic performer Twigs, who had to become FKA Twigs. And, you know, a lot of people who listen to her music, I don't think, know that FKA stands for formerly known as. And, you know, you just tack something on with the original moniker, and you can retain your fan base and, you know, still grow it, and maybe it'll just be a blip in your career that you were ever called anything else. Then there's a New York band called Ejecta who had become Young Ejecta. And, you know, just changing that slightly, it enables a more seamless transition.
Well, let's hear from one of those. Blink 182 is a band that all of us have heard of. Here is the band that forced them to change their name, albeit just a little. The track is called That Was a Happy Day by the Irish group Blink. Streets are bright and the doors are all open in this little place that we passed through. You had your head turned away, but I knew you were smiling because you always do. Carrot cake in the afternoon and the sun is gleaming through the green. Blink. Not a huge band, let's say. Certainly not on the Blink 182 scale. So Pat, does it do these bands any good to threaten a lawsuit? I mean, wouldn't they perhaps benefit from being confused with a bigger band of the same name?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that they definitely would. You know, more people would buy their merchandise because they'd be tricked into thinking it and that it was their favorite band. But I think it speaks well of all these bands that they're proud enough to think that, you know, we own the name Blink. You can't call us, you know, you have to change your name.
Wow, you're much more charitable than I am. I thought they just saw a big payday.
I don't know. The payday doesn't seem to be that much. You know, in a lot of the instances, I mean, a lot of the instances are undisclosed amounts. You know, the Nirvana one, which is a case that came up when Nirvana, the band that we all know as Nirvana, was starting to get popular in the 90s. They were challenged on their name by a UK band who were a psychedelic band from the 60s. And they, I guess, settled for a reported $100,000. But One Direction, just a few years ago, were challenged by a California band named One Direction. And they didn't disclose how much that settlement was, but I do imagine that was actually probably a pretty payday.
I guess that's an option to just pay him off. Let's hear a little something from the UK band, psychedelic band Nirvana. They actually did a pretty nice cover of the Kurt Cobain Nirvana song, Lithium. Let's hear it. I'm so happy, 'cause today I found my friends, they're in my head. I'm so ugly, but it's okay. And that was the band Nirvana covering the band Nirvana, who rumor has it paid $100,000 to use that name. I'm speaking with Pat Healy, who wrote about what happens when up-and-coming bands are forced to change their names. And it happened to the band Dinosaur, now known as Dinosaur Jr. It happened to Led Zeppelin, previously called the New Yardbirds. And it happened to the metal band The Champs, who now go by, let's say, the Effing Champs. Not a very radio-friendly band name. Let's talk about another forced band name change, Santigold. What's the story there?
Well, with a lot of these cases, the artist who has to change their names are, you know, they're just on the rise. They're just breaking. And, you know, they're probably going through, one of those days where every hour of their day is booked up with a publicity appearance or this or that. And the original person gets wind of it because they're getting good publicity. So Santi White was calling herself Santo Gold. And then the person who originally called himself Santo Gold must have gotten wind of it through this breeze of publicity. And he apparently had an infomercial on New York television in the 80s. And he made some sort of wrestling movie, I believe. And he was furious that somebody was taking his name. And I guess Santi White just didn't want any hassle at all, so she just used her regular name, Santi, and just became Santi Gold. And yet I think he was looking to capitalize upon that publicity and made this song for the occasion.
Well, let's hear just a clip of that.
I'm the real Santo Gold. I'm the real Santo Gold. I'm the real Santo Gold. I don't like my name being stole. Spent millions on my name, Santo Gold, because I'm the real Santo Gold.
Geez, I'm not sure if he's really accomplished his goal. What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, well, as I said in the story, it's kind of a sad twist that when you actually type in Santo Gold into Google, the results say, did you mean Santigold?
Oh.
You know, yeah.
You mentioned that in the case of the London suede, just adding the location. What's the story there?
Well, it seems to be the case where a band's name is claimed by another band with the same name, and they can just alleviate the, or they can just diffuse the situation by adding the UK next to their name, or London, or, you know, Squeeze began their life as Squeeze UK because there was another band with a similar name. I believe they're called Tight Squeeze, and they challenged them, so they put it there. But even Wham was Wham UK. But what is interesting to me is that no bands have gone the humorous route that way and, you know, just started up a band in America and just called it something UK. Or, you know, like, wouldn't it be great to take a band like the Rolling Stones US or something? Yeah.
Well, it is funny that, you know, you have the London Suede, Charlatans UK, the English Beats, all these English bands that are getting hit
right
with.
Right. Well, it seems like it was more, this happened more often in the age before Google. Mm. But now it's interesting that within the past year, you still have a lot of cases. And I think what that is coming from is bands, the lesser known bands, have a Google alert on their name or something. And, you know, can you imagine your inbox blowing up and saying, yeah, people are writing about my band. And then you're like, oh, no, Scarlett Johansson is just named her band after my band.
Oh, the poor singles.
I know. I was thinking that they should just call themselves the effing singles, you know. It's a double entendre. They're working it. But yeah, I mean, there's so many alternatives and options, and you know, I like to think that the article I wrote was kind of a guide for what that band should do next.
Well, Pat Healy, U.S., a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Virginia.
Pat Healy writes about music, and you can read his article for Pace Magazine on bands that have had to change their names. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. When we think of early rock and roll, many of us think of musicians like Elvis Presley or Little Richard or Johnny Cash. But all of those legends grew up listening to an unlikely guitar hero, the gospel musician Sister Rosetta Tharpe. One historian says it's time to reevaluate her legacy in rock and roll. Allison Quantz reports.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe made gospel music mainstream. She took spiritual songs like this one, sung here by the Sella Jubilee Singers. And made them a little bit rock and roll.
And the way, the inflection that she put on the term rock me and the way she rolled the R's was quite shocking at the time and suggested something much more worldly than this sort of protective spirit.
This is Chris Kajornis, a professor at Longwood University. He says that Tharpe's style has its foundation in the Black Pentecostal Church.
Pentecostal churches had a big influence on early rock and roll and this just excitement and fervor and filling with the Spirit. When you think about it, women swooning and passing out when they see an Elvis Presley or a Beatles and they're hearing this music relates much more closely to what you would see at a Pentecostal service than what you would see at, say, a blues club.
Tharpe grew up in the church, and from the age of 4, she was making music. Here's a later recording of her.
This is when she was playing the solid body electric guitar, and you just feel this energy. You can hear her stomping her foot.
Sit down! No, I can't sit down. Sit down! Uh-uh, I can't sit down. Go away, don't bother me. I can't sit down. I feel so happy and I can't sit down. Sit down!
And you can just imagine everyone jumping up and stomping with her.
Throughout the 1920s, Tharpe and her mother traveled the country, preaching and using music to bring people into the church. Then, in the 1930s, a temple in Miami started broadcasting Tharpe's performances on the radio.
And you can imagine hearing this on the radio and going, I want to be where that is. You have white listeners, you have Jewish listeners that are packing the balcony while the congregants are down on the floor and everyone is enjoying this music.
Tharp became the first superstar of gospel music, and her sound inspired some of the greats of rock and roll.
Johnny Cash, in his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech, said that that was his favorite singer as a child, was Rosetta Tharp.
Not just Johnny Cash, but Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, Little Richard, all legends who grew up listening to Rosetta Tharp on the radio and stomping their feet along with her. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quance.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and to explore. We encourage you to go to wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.